You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, December 13th, 2021. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Elizabeth Samet, professor of English at West Point, author of Looking for the Good War, American Amnesia and the Violent Pursuit of Happiness. Meanwhile, over 60 people dead, 100 unaccounted for in the wake of tornadoes, massive tornadoes in Kentucky. Meanwhile, Democrats are racing to avoid the child tax credit expiration, trying to pay homage to the God of Manchin. New poll, Joe Biden's approval numbers sinking as his administration pledges to restart student loan collections. Mark Meadows on January 5th told the National Guard to stand by to protect Trump supporters tomorrow, that being January 6th. Meanwhile, New York Times reports U.S. military airstrikes killed far, far more civilians in Syria than reported. California's Governor Newsom, in light of the Texas abortion law, calls for similarly structured legislation from his legislature regarding guns in California. Congratulations, folks. Corporate buybacks hit a record new high in 2021. And in this country, we are closing in on 800,000 deaths. One in every 100 U.S. citizens over the age of 65 have died of COVID. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for joining us at the beginning of this new week as we head in, start the sprint to the end of the year. With me, I feel like I recognize, that's the first time I think I have ever recognized like an outfit you've worn.
Oh, well, I mean, that's maybe because I pointed out that Stitch Fix made this.
Is that what it is?
Yeah, maybe that's why it's stuck in your brain. Or not, I don't know if they make their own stuff, but this is what I got from Stitch Fix.
Oh, I don't know what that is. I think it's just like it's a different color palette
it's
for you.
It's fuzzy, too. Like, it looks, I mean, and I...
Texture
this,
thing.
There's something about this, too, because Matt commented on it as well. And Matt said, I like that material.
I like fuzzy stuff.
It is a fuzzy one. It's
a... I don't think I've ever heard you comment on any...
That's okay.
You know Matt. He loves fuzzy stuff.
Oh, of course. That's
right.
What people say.
This is the number one thing.
You know, when I get, sometimes I get recognized on the street, and one of the first questions people ask me, does Matt really love fuzzy stuff?
Oh, yeah. Right.
And I'm like, yeah, he's now is it the lining of your pants?
Lining of my pants is fuzzy today.
All right.
That's something you've got to, like, I mean, if you're from North Dakota, when it gets cold,
we need to talk about that, where
there
you get those pants.
There are jeans that have fuzzy insides.
Yep. We need to talk about that. I've been
fuzzy,
trying to find
fuzzy
line
was a
pants,
bear.
And I'm having trouble with that.
Right.
Just a note. Friend of show. I mean, maybe he doesn't perceive himself as I perceive him. So, a friend of show, Ted Leo. He did our opening. He has a single that he is selling. We have a link to it that. All the proceeds, 100% of the proceeds, go to two organizations that are dealing with the new Texas restriction on abortion, basically shutting down abortions in Texas. Jane's Due Process, which helps young people in Texas navigate parental consent laws and confidentially access abortion and birth control, and the Frontera Fund, which makes abortion accessible in the Rio Grande Valley by providing financial and practical support regardless of immigration status, gender identity, ability, sexual orientation, race, class, age, or religious affiliation. And they are building grassroots organizing power at intersecting issues across the region to shift the culture of shame and stigma. So those two organizations, I guess I don't know how they're divvying it up between those two. I assume it's a split. But check it out. You can buy this digital song for $2, but you can buy it for whatever price you want. So head over there, Ted Leo, working with some other people. I think Spencer Ackerman's involved or something. I'm not quite sure. But
cool.
Check it out. We have a link at the on the website at majority.fm, the YouTube description, and in the podcast. So look for that. And also on that site, you can buy tickets to Majority Live, the big live show to celebrate the anniversary of January 16th. Mm. Nothing really happened on January 16th in 2020, but or 2021 for that matter.
10 days from January 6th.
It's 10 days from January 6th.
Right.
So that's why. Check
when
it out.
Really set in what happened. And
Natalie
Scherr
is going to be there. John Benjamin, Larry Murphy. We may have one or two other guests. We shall see. And, you know, we're all going to be there.
In person.
The whole crew.
You'll be able to see our legs.
I'm not promising anything like that. We may, I may put like a table with a skirt around it.
No calves for you.
Yeah. You'll see them as we walk to our chairs.
Oh, good.
At the very least. I'm not quite sure. We got to figure that out, too. I got a lot of stuff to do. But people are going to be there.
I haven't even thought about the leg logistics.
Yeah, I know. So these tornadoes in Kentucky are very rare for this time of year. And huge for this time of year. There is a lot of reason to believe this is a function of global climate change. There's no one weather incident that you can point to and say with any, definitively this is a function of climate change. But when you start having weird weather patterns and more extreme weather patterns and weirder weather events, and you know that global temperatures are getting hotter in certain areas, maybe cooler in certain areas during certain times, and these strange, in this instance, it was a brutal weather event. And it's not just a function, obviously, these deaths are not just a function of the tornado. Could be a function of, let's say, in the Amazon facility that was there, they don't allow their workers to have cell phones, so they're not necessarily aware of.
They're not getting the alert.
They're not getting those alerts that go off. I know that, on my phone, I get that emergency alert thing that goes off when there's a hurricane watch or warning.
And for these tornadoes, I mean, the process by which a tornado is created, right? It's like a thunderstorm turns into a tornado. My scientific literacy isn't that great, but that's what I understand. That's why climate change is involved here, because it can create conditions that increase the intensity of that and make tornadoes turn more aggressive.
It's a differential in temperatures at different heights, essentially. And in the winter, you don't get tornadoes because generally the air is too dry, or dry and cool, and so you don't get that updraft. And apparently, that's not the case.
It was in the 60s here this weekend. So.
And so to be clear, there are some when you have a weather event like this. There are some deaths that are going to be a function of of just simply these things can are unavoidable. But there are other deaths that are a function of practices, maybe practiced by Amazon in this instance. Maybe they didn't get enough warning for their workers. What we can do as a society, of course, is, you know, deal with maybe the underlying issues dealing with climate change, but also respond as a society, because there's no way individuals in Kentucky can rebuild in this way. And Kentucky as a state does not have the millions, hundreds of millions of dollars, I would imagine, maybe more, of dollars and of resources to rebuild. That is why a federal government, we look to the federal government to come in and help our neighbors. We don't live anywhere near Kentucky, but that's why we're all in a society together. That's the way the American society, we have a federal government. There are Republican lawmakers, libertarians, self-styled, who have said many, many times in the past. Here's an example, for instance, Rand Paul mocking people who say that we should spend money in situations like this.
It's from 2017.
So people here will say they have great compassion and they want to help the people of Puerto Rico and the people of Texas and the people of Florida. But notice they have great compassion with someone else's money. Ask them if they're giving any money to Puerto Rico. Ask them if they're giving money to Texas. Ask them what they're doing to help their fellow man. And you'll find often that it's easy to be compassionate with someone else's money.
Who's the someone else? Who's the someone else?
I mean,
it is a collective pot of money, which, like, we don't even need to, as you point out many times, like, spending and taxation can be decoupled. But this is, buying into his premise, this is everybody's money that we've contributed into the pot.
He believes that taxation is theft. Mm. He believes that we shouldn't have a community pot, as it were, that we shouldn't have a society that is organized around these things. Or I should say, he believed those things until that tornado hit Kentucky. Because now Rand Paul is calling for Joe Biden and the federal government to come in. He's calling FEMA. He's bragging about how he's calling FEMA and asking them to come in. Massey, what's his name? Thomas Massey, congressman from Kentucky. Exact same deal. Exact same deal. Put that Twitter thread that Rand Paul in the past. Bradley, put that up. All right, well, put up, this is for Massey. I thought you had the Twitter thread for Rand Paul. Rand Paul, this is it. I mean, there's a whole...
Rand Paul opposition to previous disaster relief research.
Yes. I mean, there's a whole Twitter thread that's up there with every time that he hasn't, that he's said no, like every date that is there. But Massey, same thing. Hit the Massey one right there. Often votes against national disaster relief, except when Kentucky's involved. That's back in 2019 by his own newspaper, Courier Journal. All right. You can take it down. I mean, that is... I don't know. Nobody gets punished for hypocrisy, but it is important to see the lie that is embedded in this libertarian ideology. And it's borne out by the fact that everybody's a libertarian until they need help from the federal government, I guess. Until they need somebody to protect their property rights.
Then it's not really other people's money.
Or when they need a monopoly of force for their benefit.
And by the way, the Amazon facility that was devastated by these tornadoes. Just as an aside, maybe we should be hearing something from Jeff Bezos as opposed to thoughts and prayers for the families.
He should be asked why there wasn't proper safety protocols and places for people to go during a storm at his warehouses. They should be in front of Congress.
You gotta
perhaps
save.
Rand Paul could do his, you know, say he doesn't want, he wants to stick to his principles and not ask for money from the federal government, which he's doing anyway. He could do something else and hold Jeff Bezos accountable and Amazon as well for the fact that there were not the proper protocols in place and many people died as a result of that. But that's, that would get in the way of the free market, I guess.
There was also apparently a candle factory in Mayfield, I'm being told, in Kentucky, as to whether that was built, the shelter that they were in was built to standards. But we'll see. I mean, you don't want Bezos to spend, take any money away from his ability to do his joyrides into space.
Yeah.
All right, couple of sponsors. When we come back, we'll be talking to Professor Elizabeth Sammet, English professor at West Point, author of Looking for the Good War, American Amnesia and the Violent Pursuit of Happiness. Like I say, a couple of sponsors today. Did you know that we had a did you know?
Stitch Fix today?
Yes.
No, I didn't know. I didn't know.
Well done.
But look at that. So last time I wore the sweater, I came into the office and I said, oh, do we have Stitch Fix today? And you said no. I said, that's unfortunate because this is my new getup. And I was wearing the pants they gave with this outfit. Not today, though. But
now,
I'm almost fully head to toe in Stitch Fix right now, by the way.
Right now, Bradley.
What is going on?
Shirt and pants.
All right. Well, let me get into the copy, for God's sakes. The whole point of Stitch Fix is you can develop your style. There you go.
Uh-huh.
Or you can shift your style. With Stitch Fix Freestyle, it's a shop that evolves alongside with your taste. Your closet is going to scream, so you, without actually, of course, screaming. Mm. It's a metaphor.
That's good. I don't want a screaming closet.
Introducing Stitch Fix Freestyle. It is a shop built just for you. Stitch Fix Freestyle is your trusted style destination where you can discover and instantly buy curated items based on your style, likes, and lifestyle. You know, you do a thumbs up, thumbs down type of thing. They send you, you know, you just click through a bunch of different styles. I like this. I don't like that. I like this. I don't like that. And then they start to get a sense of what your style is. And doesn't matter whether you're looking for a brand that you love already or you want to try a new one. At Stitch Fix Freestyle, you can shop a range of over 1,000 brands that are personalized to your size and your fit. Styles for workouts, workwear, for lounging around the house, or for a night out on the town, Stitch Fix Freestyle has clothes for any occasion. And there's no subscription required. They offer free shipping. They offer free returns. They offer free exchanges. And it's super, super easy. Very easy. That is always the thing that scares me about buying stuff.
Mm-hmm.
There are some places you buy stuff online, and it's almost palpable how they're making it hard for you to return it.
Oh, yeah.
Stitch Fix, envelope's right there. Bingo, bango. You try it on. You don't like it. You put it back in the envelope. Your postman picks it up. Or post lady. Mail carrier.
No, we need to get hung up on that.
I don't need to get carried. Yeah. Well, we've already talked about different styles. I was going to talk about my cardigan sort of baseball style sweater, but I don't even need to do that now.
Is that what I see on the couch over there?
No, that's actually that is not. That's a different one, actually. That's a zip up sort of mock turtleneck, but it's in my cubby.
Oh.
Yeah.
Now we had cubbies.
Well, I only built one with a door prior to COVID.
Oh,
and I haven't done the
look
other
at
two.
That. The boss gets a cubby.
Well, there's other cubbies there. It's just no door on it. I'm going to fix the door. But the point is Stitch Fix. It's a great way to expand your sartorial horizons or to edify them. I made that up myself. Get started today by filling out your style quiz at stitchfix.com/majority. That's stitchfix.com/majority to try Stitch Fix Freestyle, stitchfix.com/majority. Also, today's episode is sponsored by Honey. Everybody shops online. Everybody's had that same feeling at one time or another. The promo code taunts you. Am I paying full price for this? It drives me crazy. It used to, I should say. And I've gone through this story a million times. Like when Milo started buying stuff online, I was like, dude, before you do anything, you search for the promo code. Nope. And you got to try them. You got to try. You get to that one of those sites, you got to try five different promo codes. It was a bit of a pain, but there's nothing like getting $5 off for just taking the extra minute. Well, it's much easier now. Honey is the free browser extension that scours the internet for promo codes and then applies the best one it finds to your cart. It supports over 30,000 stores online, Honey does, ranging from sites that have tech and gaming products to popular fashion brands, even food delivery. So here's how it works. You're shopping on one of your favorite sites. When you check out, the Honey button drops down automatically. All you have to do is click apply coupons. It cycles through all the possible coupons. If it finds one that works, bing, you save, I don't know, $3, $5, $7 sometimes.
I've saved like 25% off using that.
I mean, you can save a ton of cash. And for me, the best part is if there's no coupon codes, it says no coupon codes. And then you feel like, okay, I'm getting the lowest price.
It's
and sometimes
really,
Honey
really
has like
not
a
the best part.
Price drop thing. For me, it is. I just don't like FOMO.
Better than getting the discount.
I mean, I just want to feel secure that I'm getting the cheapest price.
Okay.
I mean, at least expensive, I should say. Honey has found over 17 million members, over $2 billion in savings. I have saved money on pants recently. Myla has saved money on clothes far too many times than I care to imagine. Mm. And also some makeup she bought recently. Huh. Yep. If you don't already have Honey, you could be straight up missing out on free savings. It's literally free and installs in a few seconds. And by getting it, you're doing yourself a solid and you're supporting the podcast. Get Honey for free at joinhoney.com/majority. That's joinhoney.com/majority. And lastly, as the holidays approach, there's still a lot of jobs to fill, like holiday lighting installer, advanced snowmaker, or no beard Santa. This is apparently a clean-shaven man who wears a synthetic beard.
Hmm.
If you're hiring, there's only one place you should go. It's the place where we have gotten at least a significant portion of our staff, 25%. I mean, Bradley's second generation, but ZipRecruiter.com/majority. ZipRecruiter uses powerful technology to find and match the right candidates up with your job, and then it proactively presents these candidates to you. You can easily review these recommended candidates, invite your top choices to apply for your job, which, in my experiences, encourages them to apply faster. No wonder ZipRecruiter is the number one rated hiring site in the U.S. This is based on G2 ratings. In fact, ZipRecruiter's technology is so effective that 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. That was also my experience. We've got a ton of great folks, and their interface really helps you organize it. Right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/majority. Discover hiring joy with ZipRecruiter. Just jingle your way to ZipRecruiter.com/majority.
Jingle all the way.
Yep. Okay. Want to welcome to the program Professor Elizabeth Samet. She's a professor of English at West Point, author of Looking for the Good War, American Amnesia, and the Violent Pursuit of Happiness. And we should say the views of Elizabeth Samet expressed here do not reflect official policy or position of the Department of Army, the Department of Defense, or the U.S. government, which apparently we've got to say because you're employed at West Point. And frankly, based upon the book, I'm not surprised. Professor, welcome to the program. I'm here with Emma Viglin.
Thank you so much. I'm glad to be here with you both.
Yes, thank you.
So let's start with, and I have to say, I cannot tell you, I don't think I ever contemplated that there would ever be a book that would come out that would take Tom Brokaw and Steven Spielberg to task for the model and narrative that they have created over the years. I've always found it problematic, and it's nice to see it at least, you know, that supported it by academia. But let's talk about the prevailing, I guess, myth that has been created around World War II, and maybe we'll get into the those six main elements of that myth.
Sure. So, as you suggest, Spielberg and Brokaw and Stephen Ambrose, the architects of what we might call the 50th anniversary mythology of the war. And I think that's the most, there have been many myths of World War II, but I think that's the most powerful one. And the tenets that I suggest in the book are as follows, that the United States went to war to liberate the world from fascism and tyranny, which was, of course, a consequence of the war, but not necessarily the motivation for joining it. That all Americans were absolutely united in their commitment to the war effort. And that tenet, I think, gained a lot of traction after subsequent wars, which had nothing like the same consensus. And so there was a certain nostalgia for an earlier war in which at least most people seemed to be in agreement. The third is that everyone on the home front made tremendous sacrifices. The fourth, that Americans are liberators who fight decently and only when they must. The fifth, that World War II was a foreign tragedy with a happy American ending. And then the last, and these tenets are modeled on George Orwell's maxims for the writer in his essay, Politics in the English Language, that everyone has always agreed on points 1 through 5. And I suggest that deep down, we know that these myths aren't necessarily true, but they have become reflexive, and we invoke them all the time, especially when we confront all of the other wars that have followed in the wake of World War II.
So let's. I want to take each one and dig into them a little deeper. But let's start. Like when did these? Did they all form simultaneously, or I guess in did these myths all sort of like grow concurrently, I guess, over the years, or were they sort of like sequentially deployed?
I think that they grew by fits and starts. There isn't necessarily a sequence to them, but at certain points in our history, they were more prevalent than others. And as I said, they arose mostly later, although not all of them. The first one, I would say, the idea of why we went to war, began before we stopped fighting. So where one can see the transformation, we can see it in a lot of different places, but where you can see it very clearly is in some of the products the government made for American service members. So there were these little guides, pocket guides to the various countries in which service members found themselves. And you can very clearly see in the guide to Germany, for example, which has a section that tells service members why they're fighting in Germany, which had to sort of combat some of the kind of natural allegiances, I think, that Americans felt, or at least they didn't feel that Germans were necessarily an enemy. And so these books sort of explained why. And they explained the roots of fascism. And they also recast America's role in the 30s, which is, of course, an isolationist one. But they recast it as this threat that America had recognized all along. And so then you begin to see the way that it changes, and we sort of backdate our participation. We backdate our interest in world affairs, and we backdate our recognition of the very real dangers of fascism, which were that recognition came quite late, I think.
And part of that is, like, I would imagine fits quite well into the erasure of Soviet Union participation in the fight, right? Where there's very little understanding, I think, domestically about how many millions of Soviet soldiers died in World War II. And I mean, I would imagine that part of that rewriting of history fits in well with the Cold War that begins after the war.
I think the role of the Russians, the role of the Soviet Union was extremely difficult, especially to explain to American service members. So first, the Soviet Union was allied with Germany, then allied with us, and then after the war and the Cold War, the enemy again. And so I think that became a particularly difficult, thorny problem. And this parts of this myth did succeed in erasing that as well.
What's fascinating is the idea that they have to hand out pamphlets as to why you're fighting here sort of undercuts the idea that everybody understood why they were fighting there.
And I think it's unrealistic to expect that everyone in an army understands all of the philosophical or political commitments animating any conflict. Many are concerned quite rightly with short-term survival. But it was certainly true that for the French, which tried to explain why the French were our allies and tried to overcome a kind of natural distaste, it would appear, between the Americans and the French, explaining the role of Lafayette, explaining the role of the French in the American Revolution, and that the French were like us, lovers of liberty, was something that these books, particularly as toward the end of the war and afterwards, as we have occupied France and became increasingly the tensions between Americans and French, as has been documented by many historians, became increasingly intense.
We're going to talk obviously more about this, and I want to keep going through this list. But it seems to me that these myths are propagated by the U.S. government, and then there are entities in our society that find it, you know, for whatever reason, that like it's just much easier to ride these myths that have already been initiated. I mean, the myths are established, right, by the U.S. government to get the military, to get people in the military to do their job. And I mean, I'm struck by the idea of like how it's almost the opposite of what happened in the context of Iraq. And it may be the opposite in other military interventions, but this one I was, you know, an adult. Like, we knew why we were going into Iraq, even though, I mean, you know, supposedly on day one, which was we got to fight them over there before we fight them over here. And we don't want the firing gun or whatever it is to be a smokestack, you know, a nuclear, you know, mushroom cloud. And then all that seemed to unravel as we got there, which is sort of the opposite, it feels like, in terms of World War II. But let's head to number two, that we were all united in this fight.
But I would say that this number two, and really the entire myth, you know, you said that they're propagated by the government. I think myth works in slightly more mysterious ways than that, and in some kinds of insidious ways. So I don't think they're all sort of part of an official propaganda campaign. I think they are certainly encouraged. The rhetoric of that war was used to justify later wars, I think, certainly. But I think that this tenet as well, in the terms of being people being absolutely united, arose in the wake of wars in which Americans were emphatically not united. So Vietnam, perhaps the most obvious case. But I think that a lot of the discussion of everyone being welcomed home with open arms became a sort of nostalgic glance for Americans who did not necessarily welcome Vietnam veterans home and did not embrace them and confused perhaps the war with those who fought it, which is something I think we've tried to atone for yet again in these conflicts. But I do think that if you look at the films and the books of the time and you look at the newspapers of the time and other documentation, you'll see that those soldiers, there were so many of them, you know, millions returning, were a source of great anxiety rather than people we welcomed home with great enthusiasm. Although, of course, I think the enthusiasm was certainly greater than in later wars.
But didn't, like, I guess what I'm saying about the government propaganda, like I can just Google, you know, United World War II, and I'm imagining that we would have, I don't know how many posters that would say, you know, we're united, and that, you know, the government generates these, I guess, memes, for lack of a better term. I don't think that's what they would call them at that time. And they're picked up because they maybe, I don't know, follow some romanticized version, and they become easier for, you know, Spielberg. We'll get into Spielberg a little bit in a bit. But I mean, he, you know, he He liked big ideas like that. After his first movie bombed, everything after that was going to be sort of broad and accessible. And what's more accessible than essentially, you know, getting a theme from a war poster?
And I think, well, I think cries for unity, for rallying around various symbols and ideas is part and parcel of any nation going to war. Absolutely. I do think also that in the case of this war, and this is part of the power of the myth, it offers us the most flattering version of ourselves. That's why it's so seductive. That's why I think it makes such good movies. And that's why I think the mythology of the 50th anniversary celebrations of the war were so powerful. And part of my point is that, it celebrating the war in the way we do, I think condemns us to, looking backwards rather than forwards. And we keep sort of searching for a war that will have the same kinds of effects, the same kinds of consequences.
Let's talk about number three, the home front sacrifices. That feels like, you know, us trying to sort of make us feel like, well, yeah, the British had to go underground because of bombings in Germany. Well, we firebombed a lot of cities, and the Russians lost millions of lives. But people had to go into factories here. I mean, there sort of feels like there's a little bit of insecurity involved in that one, too.
Well, we, of course, have had the great good fortune of not having a war on our home soil since the Civil War. And so there is certainly a sense in which, you know, when we look at the sacrifices of the British, as you suggest, are seem too pale in comparison. In many ways, the war, of course, brought America back to work. People made and had more money than they'd ever had in their lives. And so that feeling of prosperity coexisted, I think, uneasily with the idea of sacrifice. There were, of course, official sacrifices of rationing and other things, but I don't think that everyone sacrificed to the degree that we remember it as we do now.
And that we were going to be treated as liberators. Tell us about that one.
So I think one of the great consequences of World War II was, of course, the liberation of Europe from the tyrannies of fascism. And I think that that's, you know, not up for debate. This is not an argument. My book is not an argument that our participation was either unnecessary or unjustified. I think it was belated. And I think it was not for the reasons that we later attributed it necessarily. But we did undeniably achieve that liberation in Europe. And as I said, that gave us, I think, the most flattering view of ourselves. And yet the consequence of that subsequently seemed to have given to our ideas of American violence a kind of exceptionalism, that whenever employed elsewhere in the world, unlike the military force of other nations, it would inevitably lead to a similar conclusion. And of course, we've seen the many ways in which that has not played out. But the rhetoric of liberation is always, almost always employed when we do decide to use military force around the world.
Well, that's like, I mean, that's when you said, just to quickly interject, that we will be greeted as liberators kind of concept, that is directly copy and pasted into the Iraq War, the most, you know, consequential conflict that we've engaged in since, I mean, maybe not since Vietnam, right?
Right. And we seem to have this perpetual capacity for being surprised when we're not greeted as liberators.
Right.
And that too owes to the World War II mythology.
This notion of foreign tragedy, but a happy end that is an American one. I mean, that seems also sort of built into this notion of trying to, that when we engage in a war, it is sort of fundamentally different than when other countries engage in a war.
I think that, yes, that too is part of our exceptionalist idea, which of course far predates World War II, but gathered a lot of momentum from it. And, it, you know, it's Reinhold Niebuhr who, after the war and the irony of American history, suggested that Americans sort of thought of tragedy as a kind of European problem, that it was something not associated with them. And I think we do have a kind of reluctance to view the world as anything but comic in that richer sense, not the humor sense, but in that sense of having happy endings. And so we want to put them on all of our stories, and that does not always work out.
Let's talk about how, like, where, and then that everyone agrees with one through six. I mean, how did that play out? I mean, when I think of that, I just think of, like, I don't know, like that guy Meacham and Tom Brokaw sitting around, and, you know, maybe even Brian Williams trying to get in on that a little bit, of just talking about the Greatest Generation. And I don't know, we just saw it with Bob Dole. Like, it was as if nothing happened in his whatever it was, 60-year long career as a politician, and we're still talking about him from World War II.
I think it is intensified in this period as well by the fact that the numbers of World War II veterans are dwindling, and dwindling quickly. And I think that's often in the news. And I think that makes this intense identification with this earlier time even more urgent. But it is true, it seems as if that singular event eclipses the rest of someone's career in moments like that.
I mean, but let's talk about, like, where, how, you know, what it is, where this myth grew, I guess, because was it growing, you know, when we talk about Spielberg, or we talk about Tom Brokaw, we're talking about it almost like in the 50th anniversary of the war. Like, what happened in the interim, and is this, and I guess how much of it is also a function of, like, the baby boomers? Because so much of our culture, it seems to me, is dictated by baby boomers, and it's their parents, right? Like, it's almost like there's some measure of stolen valor, or just sort of trying to put their parents on a pedestal.
Well, I think that a concatenation of different events worked to galvanize the 50th anniversary mythology. So you had not only what would come to be called the Vietnam hangover or the Vietnam syndrome, you also had the first Gulf War, which was nearly contemporaneous. And I think that certainly the first President Bush's own history as a World War II veteran played into his role as the commander-in-chief during the first Gulf War. And he clearly viewed that war as being able to, as he called it, to kick the Vietnam syndrome once and for all. So I think there was clearly a sense in which those things worked in harmony with the 50th anniversary celebrations and this cultivation, the coinage of this term, the Greatest Generation, as a way for a country whose confidence, I think, had been shaken by Vietnam, to regain a kind of earlier luster through this mythology.
Let's talk specifically about some of those people. Like, how did Brokaw, for people who don't know, I mean, I grew up in, you know, I was too conscious in the 90s. And so, and I remember just being so angry at the Saving Private Ryan movie. I got so annoyed by all of it. But will you, like, walk us through sort of, like, you know, their role? I mean, they were all, like, on some type of 50th anniversary committee, it feels like. I mean, like, literally.
So Ambrose really launched this, I think, with his several books. Stephen Ambrose, the historian, launched it with several books. And he was very open in his interviews about those books that he grew up idolizing those who fought in World War II. They were heroes. They were giants to him. And I think he wrote those histories in that way. There was a boyish hero worship that infused them all. His great gift was for these wonderful stories, right? Those histories have great narrative, and they focus on individuals. They very carefully, Band of Brothers focuses on an elite unit, And so they're very seductive as stories. They often abstract battlefield heroics from the larger question of causes. Causes are sort of assumed. He has to do something with the fact that that generation didn't talk a lot about causes. So he just attributes that to a kind of stoicism. So there's just an absence of that kind of talk, but he has to supply it. And then picking up from there, Tom Brokaw's book, The Greatest Generation, and he clearly acknowledges his debt to Ambrose's telling of the World War II story, gave another name. In addition to The Good War, we now had The Greatest Generation. And the movie Saving Private Ryan, which you've also brought up, I think, of course, was extremely influential, still is among people who think about military service, I think, as was the series Band of Brothers, which came later. But I think there too, this idea that you would abstract a very small story and a story that is sort of wildly ahistorical in its celebration of going to find one private, as if that's the most important thing in a war that was, of course, was mass mobilization and had sadly, no luxury for that. It makes it feel almost like an old-fashioned epic in which one soldier is battling it out against another. And it doesn't look like the World War II movies that were closer to the period. One that I mention in my book is 12 O'Clock High, which is the movie about an Air Force unit. And the emphasis throughout there is that you can't afford, it's the unit that matters. You can't afford to make exceptions for one person. The stakes are too high. And so the individual personality is submerged in that war. And I think that, you know, many of the memoirists of the period or later and others recognized that this was not a war about individuals. And so it's a very strange thing to make it one.
Well, you assign it this like emotional meaning that can, I guess, buoy the story artificially or the hagiography or whatever you want to, the mythologizing of the war, because you make it this personal and moral individual, I guess, mission as opposed to reflecting the true brutality and complex reality.
Right. And a lot of the soldiers in the middle of Saving Private Ryan aren't so happy about this mission. But what happens, the sum total of the cumulative effect of the movie, that all of that dissent seems to be washed out by the frame story, which is, of course, the older Private Ryan who comes. He's an old man. He comes to the cemetery in Normandy and he visits those who died to save him. And so it's very emotional, very sentimental, and it washes out all of those questions that really are raised even by Captain Miller, the head of the commander of the company that has to go save him.
I also found there was a sort of subsidiary theme in that movie that I felt was sort of deployed to address any of the questions of like, hey, should we have dropped both those nuclear weapons or should we have firebombed Dresden? And that was, you can't let one German escape. You cannot have a shred of mercy or it will come back to get you in the form of the prisoner they captured and let go, who came back and shot one of the guys or something. Mm. Like it was just, it was sort of the secondary theme and it was sort of submerged in there, but it was basically like, it was, you know, it was number six of your list. Like we've all got to be on the same page here. What we're doing is completely righteous, and both in a moral and in a sort of like a practical material way.
And I think its focus, you know, you mentioned the atomic bombs. You know, these stories are for the most part in the European theater, and I think that's for a reason, because it's a lot harder to wrestle with the Pacific theater. And so I think its focus on that is designed not to have to deal with any of those other issues. And also, that idea of showing mercy and then having that come back to haunt you, which is a frequent motif, I think, that you see in war movies, but not only of World War II, but certainly is one of the running themes of that film.
Is this, because I want to talk a little bit about what was taking place in the 50s, because this, you write about the noir movement in film, and very often it involved a vet from World War II in it, which it is fascinating, because it's sort of like an allusion to the fact that, like, look, this is dark stuff. There is like some dark stuff happening underneath the surface here. That is a function of, you know, people get just really sort of shattered in war, and they come back and you don't necessarily see it on the surface. But does the, and I want you to talk about that, but also, I guess, like, is this crew of the 50th anniversary folks, Ambrose and Brokaw and Tom Hanks and Spielberg, and are they sort of like our version of the Dunning School in terms of for whatever purpose, creating this myth that we supposedly need at this time or whatever it was, or for whatever reason that now, you know, hopefully in, maybe you are a part of that response. I'm wondering just like if there's a parallel there and what's going on with this country that we need to do this.
So I think in one important sense, there's not a parallel. I think the Dunning School was clearly animated by racism, by white supremacy, by a desire to unmake history in its celebration of the lost cause, and in its dismantling of an understanding of Reconstruction that had existed before. So I think in that way, it's very different. I don't attribute the same sinister motives to those who mythologize World War II. But there is a similarity in the way the wars have been mythologized, in that I do think that myths born of whatever reason, with whatever good intentions, even if in this case it's a kind of uncomplicated veneration of ancestors, as you attributed to the baby boomer generation, possibly, that these myths always have a double edge, and that in this case, the myth of World War II has, I think, licensed in many ways subsequent uses of American force. And to the extent that we are emerging from the damage done by Civil War lost cause mythology, and I think we are slowly anyway, that can serve as a kind of parallel as we think about what will be the long-term damage of World War II mythology. And I think we're at a moment now, I mean, if you think about it, World War II is only half as old as the Civil War, and it's not sort of sealed off in the past quite yet. And so maybe there is still an opportunity, at least that's my hope, that we can think about it anew, and that might also help us exert more rational restraint in the future application of military force.
Talk about that noir period a little bit. But I'm also, as you were saying that, I was also reminded that, I guess in the wake of World War II, or maybe in the run-up, like, we started to name some of our bases, and the naming using Southern general, you know, Confederate generals sort of came into fashion. But I imagine that was just sort of a way of like, we want to make as many people as comfortable as possible in our military, unless, of course, they're not white. During World War II, right? I mean, that was.
Yeah. So the naming conventions really date back to World War I. And of course, you know, the 50th anniversary celebrations of the Civil War occurred during the administration of Woodrow Wilson, whose racism is now, I think, finally coming, certainly has come to light. I think that he went a long way toward accelerating these practices and to making it, I think, he segregated the federal workforce. He certainly made it a lot easier for regional lost cause movements to have a kind of national foothold. And so the naming of bases for Confederates, and of course, many of those bases are located in the South, and they were made in coordination and conversation with local officials. And so it certainly was a desire, I think, to make people feel comfortable with those bases there. And so that practice gained or continued in World War II. And some of those were old, smaller forts that were enlarged, and then there were others that were new. Some of them have fortunately not survived. I mean, we're still reckoning with 10 forts that have Confederate names, but there were others arguably even more outrageous, like one named for Nathan Bedford Forrest, which did not survive the war, or which was decommissioned soon after.
I'm sorry, I keep referencing the film noir and then asking you another question. So you can, but I mean, talk about that dynamic. Like, what was going on with that during that era?
So, film noir, among other genres, frequently featured the returning veteran. Of course, that was just often a function of numbers, right? There were so many that they were a common feature of everyday life. It was not exceptional to make a movie about with a veteran in it. And so many of these noir and other films as well, other genres, drama, comedies, were focused, or at least had tangentially in some cases, this figure of the veteran whose life, who returned to a life that was not the one, usually a he, that he had left. And that's inherited from some World War I movies where you see the same thing. They've gone away. They're expected to resume their lives, but they can't. It's fueled by a certain animosity by the civilians at home who say, you must just want my job, who don't really, who want veterans to just get back to normal and to get over it. These veterans are also figures of suspicion. One sort of common plot shared by several films is the veteran as drifter who comes into town, and often his arrival in town coincides with a crime. The crime is usually perpetrated by a banker or by someone respectable in town. But of course, this drifter, this veteran, is often accused of it. And the interesting thing to me, or one of the most interesting things to me, is that the veteran's service record often plays a role in these films. So a detective or a district attorney will call to Washington for the service record and find that this veteran had an outstanding record, often a Silver Star, a Purple Heart, certainly a distinguished record. And then that record is sort of has a double edge to it. So sometimes it's used to say, well, someone with a record like this who served in the war so honorably, how could this person be guilty of a crime? On the other hand, here's someone who's used to dealing with problems through violent means, solving problems through violence. And so it also, it at the same time, makes the veteran more suspect. And so this becomes he's a polarizing figure. He also becomes a figure that people would rather not look at because they remind him of unpleasant times and of instability.
Was that a reflection of like a little bit more of a sort of unmythified or unvarnished look at, I mean, was that a way of expressing the sort of at least ambiguity of the experience of war that somehow just we ended up getting rid of because we needed the sort of the more sanitized version as we moved on as a country?
Yes. And I think that's the important part of the sixth tenet of the myth is that the idea that everybody has always agreed with this, with this hagiography. And of course they haven't. And I think that you could see that in films, you can see it in novels. You can see it in the history of the period. And I think that, you can also, there's another fabulous place to look for this kind of ambivalence and to look for the fact that nobody really agreed with all of these things until much later. And that's Studs Terkel's The Good War, which was a product of the 80s. So around the 40th anniversary of the war. And Terkel, as you know, this was his great genius, right, was assembling all of these collections, these interviews, and they don't make sense. They don't give you this was the way it was. They instead give you this just many different voices, many different perspectives, all colliding and contradicting one another. Sometimes even one person's testimony contradicts itself. But throughout that seems to me to be a much more positive, a much more, frankly, American way of remembrance, of remembering war, of remembering the very different elements of the legacy.
So I guess lastly, I mean, do we, for this, I mean, and this, I feel like the Greatest Generation has been sort of, you know, weaponized in so many different ways in our society. And, you know, we talked about it in the context of in the run up to the Iraq War. I imagine it also functions as a in a really difficult way for vets of the Iraq War, of Vietnam, of the Korean War. I mean, you're not the greatest generation, you know, like, I mean, that's, you know, despite the fact that you more than likely went through just as similar type of horrors and maybe had to do horrible things, but you're not the greatest generation. You're substandard on some level. Do we need to wait until a generation or two passes before this, there can be a full reckoning and a corrective of this? I mean, I would imagine at one point vets of later wars would be like, you know, that myth of, I don't know, our older brother or whatever it was, like, is not helpful for us, in addition to being thoroughly untrue and not helpful as a country in terms of like deciding where we go next.
I think with the particular connection to soldiers today and how we does that idea of the greatest generation complicate how we deal with soldiers today? Probably, because it suggests that in this earlier war, it was a lot, a lot less complicated, right, to mythologize the soldier or to think of the soldier as doing great things. These wars have been nothing like that clear to us. We also, however, respond to soldiers today with a very strange kind of, an enthusiasm followed by a sense of relief that we don't have to deal with them anymore. The thank you for your service motif is one of those things for me that it people feel they need to atone for Vietnam, but they also don't want to spend too much time thinking about what soldiers do. And so then they move on. And I think that's sort of been our response to this war. We were encouraged not to pay too much attention to it, right? The old go shopping idea to these wars. But on the other hand,
no images of returning caskets, et cetera, et cetera. Well, it's fascinating. The book is The Good War, American Amnesia and the Violent Pursuit of Happiness. Elizabeth Samet, we will put a link to that at majority.fm. Thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. I enjoyed joining you.
Thanks so much.
All right, folks. Going to head into the fun half of the program.
It occurs to me just how much, as a society, we rely on like cognitive dissonance about not just like war violence, but I was reminded with her final comment and yours as well on the coronavirus pandemic. We thank essential workers for their service, basically.
Right, and then F you when it comes for a raise.
Yeah, F you when it comes for a raise. F you when it comes for, not us, but the general population doing any mitigating efforts on COVID.
Right.
You know, we understand that our healthcare workers are overworked and that they're in like dire straits right now, but we don't want to think about too hard what they have to deal with on a daily basis.
Recognition, not compensation.
Yeah.
In fact, when it comes to COVID, it's externalizing the costs, mm-hmm. right? It's like, I'm not going to wear a mask when I go inside. It's going to give me a rash. But if our hospitals fill up, then just, you know, externalizing that inconvenience. Enough people sort of shed that inconvenience. It ends up being like, you know, a nurse or a doctor who's been working nonstop for 2 years. But
and then when it comes to war, the inconvenient thing is to examine your relationship with like nationalism.
I'm just so glad to have, like, in writing someone criticize that that Steven Spielberg and Tom Brokaw.
Yeah.
I knew a girl in college whose dad was an Iraq War vet, and they were huge about Band of Brothers and Saving Private Ryan and all that stuff.
I mean, of course.
Did you end up seeing any of the, like, equivalent movies coming out of the War on Terror, the one with Mark Wahlberg?
No, I missed a lot of those.
Yeah, I mean, I saw them out of curiosity, but Zero Dark Thirty is infamously a propaganda outfit for the CIA, which basically said that torture worked. But then there was the other one that I'm totally blanking on. Anyway.
It's interesting that
Act of Valor, right?
I don't know.
Or the Hurt Locker was the other. Lone Survivor is what I'm thinking of. Lone Survivor. But American Sniper was also a huge propaganda movie. Anyway.
There's a thing with wars where, like, the Civil War eventually, like, grew more and more to be about slavery. World War II becomes, like, the good reasons for being there are the ones needed to popularly mobilize people. But then, after the fact, the leaders act like that was the reason they were going in the first place, mm-hmm. For propaganda value. They milk for propaganda value, but don't actually address the real issue.
Right. I'm also convinced that, like, you know, once the boomers relinquish their control, and frankly, the greatest generation, right? I mean, Nancy Pelosi's talking about more time and leadership. I don't know if she's part of that generation. But once they relinquish their control over the culture, then there's more space for people who have a more sort of like actual, like a genuine story to tell it. I mean, maybe that's why it took so long with the Civil War. You know,
it's like all those people, like the unity comes after the war, and it's like, oh, look at who were, it's like this Confederate cavalry guy and that Union cavalry guy, and they're getting together to do a railroad.
Yeah. It's Young Lions. That's, I wanted to bring that up with her. That's if you want to see a good World War II movie, it's from the German perspective.
Oh.
Yeah. It's a good one.
Yeah, I hope that, like, we come to a place where we're able to do a little bit more thoughtful war movies about, like, the war on terror that aren't just satirical, but things that are biting.
No, we'll get critical war theory then, and all study of wars has to be about how
they were absolutely necessary.
Like, the body count or whatever. No, then the other thing I also want to ask her, and I'm sorry, I know we have to go into the fun half, but how much of these Hollywood movies, they work in concert with, like, the United States government for access to...
Oh, tons. And certainly World War II. You know, Greg Mitchell has written quite a bit, and we've had him on a couple of times to talk about the atomic bombs that were dropped. There was a lot of work done by the U.S. government in terms of propagandizing that stuff. I mean, I think that... I think, you know... Ambrose, Brokaw, Spielberg, the whole crew, they're not creating these myths whole cloth. They're grabbing them and they've been produced. They were produced, you know, as propaganda. And then they pluck them out because those are the best, you know, things to whatever, either because they need the emotional, you know, Ambrose needed, you know, the love of his dad or whatever, who the hell knows. But those myths are floating around out there, and they pluck them. I mean, that's always the way this is, and they are, you know, simple enough that they have legs within the context of our society. But we're going to head into the fun half, as you say, Emma. Mm. And just a reminder, you can support this program by becoming a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, an angel gets their wings, and you support the free half.
Can't make that claim without backing it up factually, but
I want proof definitively that an angel doesn't get their wings every time we get a member.
Can anybody
provide that? I'll start a Twitter thread where anybody who can provide documented evidence that an angel does not get their wings every time somebody becomes a member, I will highlight that. I will retweet it. JoinTheMajorityReport.com. So an angel gets their wings. Also, JustCoffee.coop. Fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. Get 10% off. Check that out. What else did I want to say? That's it. Matt, what's happening in the Matt Lekian media universe?
For a Left Reckoning patron, David Griscom and I started a Vladimir Lenin reading group talking about principles of Marxism, and we're going to do another one on his letters to American workers this weekend. I'll be on the Green Corn Rebellion show talking with Gregory from Oklahoma tonight. I don't know if that's going to go up live, but look forward to that on the Green Corn Rebellion show.
Oh, exciting. Greg from Oklahoma. All right, folks. See you in the fun half. 646-257-3920.
You are in for it.
All right, folks. 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
Oh, no. Oh, no. Are you ready?
Oh, no. Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back. Back. And the alpha males are back.
Just as delicious as you could imagine.
The alpha males are back. Boy, back. And the alpha males are back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back.
I take all of it to my throat.
Alpha males are back.
Snowflake says what?
The alpha males are back.
You are a madman.
And the alpha males are back.
Oh no, Sam Cedar, what a fucking nightmare.
Can you bring back DJ Dinner?
Yeah, or a couple of them, just put them in rotation.
DJ Dinner.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough for the break.
That's fucking nonsense.
See, white people doing drugs, they look worse than normal white people, and all white people look disgusting.
And the alpha males,
psych. Fuck them. Fuck them.
Snowflake says what?
What?
Snowflake says what?
A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank. Okay. I'm making stupid money. Hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank.
Matter. Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back. And the Africans are black African. And the alpha males are black. And the Africans are back.
When you see Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keeping it 100. Can't knock the hustle. Come on! Fuck them. Fuck them. Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday! Happy birthday to me, Jew boy!
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back. Africans are black. Alpha males are black. Africans are back.
Come on. Come on. Come on.
Someone needs to pay the price for blasphemy around here.
I am a total
pussy.